Four, testing, testing, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yep.
That do it? Okay.
Levels look good.
All right, good. Oh, yeah.
Hang on.
Sure.
Sorry.
That's all right. Will you pick up the questions? Okay.
Pick me up.
All right.
So, we've got the Queen of Bedlam coming out next week. Must be very exciting.
Very exciting. Absolutely.
Now you had 5 years between the publication of Speaks the Nightbird and the Queen of Bedlam, but Speaks the Nightbird was actually written many years before that, 6 years before that, or more than that.
Right, more than that.
So, was it hard to get back into it, or was the experience of the great reception that Speaks the Nightbird got, did that make it easier to want to get back into that?
Yeah, it did. You know, I came to the point where I wanted to do something else, and I wanted to get back into writing, and my first question was, what did I want to read? I didn't really want to go back strictly to the horror genre, but my thing was, what if I wanted to read a book now, what would it have been? What would it be? Mm-hmm. So I had this idea to carry Matthew forward in a series of books, and I thought, this is something I really want to read, and of course, to be able to read it, you got to write it. So I think that's, but then again, since Nightbird did get a good reception, and people seem to really like the character and like the idea, and like the setting and historical details, I thought, give it a shot and see what happens. So the answer is yes, yes, and yes, yes, and yes. But, and I enjoy history. I've always enjoyed history, reading history. And my thing was I'm trying to make history not be so dull and stuffy. And I think most people think of history as being dull and stuffy, and I want to show people that it's not dull and stuffy. For instance, the governor in Queen of Bedlam, Lord Cornbury, is anything but stuffy. And that's an historical fact that he actually did that with his choice of clothing attire there. So that's something that's strictly not dull and stuffy.
Yeah.
And also, the taverns and that people got drunk and they fought and then the prostitutes, and there was just a lot going on. It's very much similar to our lives today. So it's my thing was also that people don't really change that much. Settings may change quite a lot, and of course they do. But people, there's something in people that remains constant.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe that's part of the problem with too many historical novels. They center on what it is they're covering, the history that they're covering, and don't treat the people of that era as being the same as they are now.
I think that's true, and ignore the
seedier side.
The reality of that people have always been people, and people, by and large, will go for those for those seedy entertainments or whatever. And then I wanted to develop the mystery too. And again, as we talked before, there's an overshadowing storyline involved in these books too, that involves this Professor Fell, who is like an emperor of crime. He's brought together the criminal families of Europe, I think it's fascinating. It's fascinating to think to me what would the world be like if there really was somebody like this who was in charge of criminal families of Europe in this particular time frame. Yeah. What would he have done? What would be the purpose of doing that? So anyway, there is an overwhelming overreaching over whatever story arc that links the books together. And that was exciting to me to do too, to put that together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've got, you had all the historical research that you had done for Speaks the Nightbird. Given the gap between the two books, did you have to go and relearn a bunch of that stuff, or did you still have a lot of details in your head from...
Yeah, because I had to do a whole lot more research for Bedlam than I did for Nightbird. Strictly, simply because there's a good mosquito right there. Huh? Get it. You will edit this out, I hope. That's great. Mosquito yelling. But I had to do a lot more research because I was dealing with a real place. I mentioned Charlestown. But Fount Royal, of course, was not a real place in Nightbird, so yeah. I could get away. But I had to really research New York, and You know, I found maps of New York. The problem was I couldn't find an exact map of 1702. I found a map of like 1690 something and a map of 1730. And so I had to kind of interpolate what the city would have looked like between, you know, and the deal was I didn't make some errors because I probably relied too much on the map of 1730. So what I'm writing about is probably closer, in reality, it probably looks closer to what it was in about 1715 or so. But, you know, like I say, I got seduced by the map of 17. Because the earlier map I had from the 1690s, I couldn't read the street. Couldn't read the streets at all. Yeah. And you could see the map and the streets were written out, but it was illegible. Couldn't read it. So it's only in the 1730 map that you could really read the streets. And as I learned later, some of the street names that I used didn't come into use until about 1710 or 1714 or so. So I kind of messed up on some of the street names. But still, you know, for everything that I messed up on, I did get a lot of stuff right. You know, for every 10 things you got right, you know, you may have messed up on one thing. So, but anyway,
minor details when it comes to the historical flavor.
Well, that's what I was. And like I mentioned, I was on this panel in Anchorage, the history mystery panel, and the question was, which is more important to you, the history or the mystery? And I said, it's a great question. I started thinking about it. Well, which is more important? And I realized that, well, the mystery has to be, because I use the reverend, who's the reverend of Trinity Church at that time. Well, there's a long list of the actual reverends of Trinity Church, and I'm not using the real name of the real reverend because of his situation in the book. So right there, you're not being true to history. Yeah. And I have a book with the names of everybody who lived in New York at that time. Wow. Now, my names are not, but I don't use those. I don't use all those names, and I don't use some of the names are fictitious. So right there, you're not being exactly true to history. Yeah. So there's going to be some slippage in terms of what you can do and what you can do and can't do. Well, for instance, actually, this summer of 1702, I found out in my research that there was a huge a fever epidemic there, and a couple of hundred people died. But yet, that was the same summer that Lord Cornbury came, and I thought, you know, the fever idea, I could use it, say, in some other book, but I can't use it in this book right now because there would be too much going on.
Yeah.
You know, because really, A Queen of Bedlam is almost like two books in one. It's about Matthew's becoming involved with the Herald Agency, becoming the problem solver, and then the thing with the mystery of the masker and the Queen of Bedlam. So you really can't put anything else in there with a fever epidemic. Yeah. Historically, there was a fever epidemic that summer. So I can't use that. So that right there means, well, have you been true to history? No, I'm not. But I did want to use Lord Cornbury. I mean, how can you not use Lord Cornbury? Well, excuse me.
Too colorful a character.
Oh, absolutely. But one deal also is that, you know, I started out in 1699 with Nightbird because that was probably one of the last years that people really thought that there might be witches. I mean, that feeling was beginning to go away. So by the time the 1700s came around, really by 1700s, that had gone away. People were beginning to be more enlightened. So 1699, the Carolina colony. Then the next book I wanted to do, I didn't want Matthew to be that much older.
Yeah.
You know, so I thought, well, 2 or 3 years later, you know, I wanted to be in New York. I wanted to be in a place where there's more going on. So, you know, that's why ideally I would have liked to have set it in about 1730, the whole series in about 1730. Then you'd have probably more going on. You'd have probably shadows and shades of the coming revolution.
Yeah.
You'd be able to do some spy stuff and some, you know, skullduggery stuff. But I couldn't because I had started the series out in 1699 with the witch trial.
Yeah.
So that was kind of limiting in a way. But the deal is you have to do what you have to, you know, do what you can with where you are, and make the best of it, you know, as best you can.
Well, I personally find it a little bit more interesting than it might have been if it had been set later, simply because I don't know anything about the early 1700s. You know, we're taught the American Revolution, so everybody had a
but
idea
the early, yeah, the you're right, years, you're right,
but not the early decades.
Yeah.
So from that aspect, I find it real interesting.
Well,
to read these.
You really kind of had to pick and choose, though, because I read a novel about 1700, set in about 1700, and everything is nasty and everything is muddy and brutish, and you know, the rats are wild. That's true. That was going on there. But you know, I have chosen to do it in a different way. I've chosen not to focus on the rats and the garbage, and you know, and there is some of that too. But I've chosen to focus on something else. So in other words, I've kind of Disney-fied in a way because I haven't cleaned it up, but it's just what I've chosen to focus on. But yeah, you're right. I mean, most people don't know much about that era. You know, your knowledge of colonial America only starts with the Revolution.
Yeah.
And there was so much more going on, and you know, fascinating interactions with Indians and pirates and a lot more. I mean, a lot more going on. There was a lot of stuff going on, and one thing that experts really don't agree on. How sophisticated the city was. Some experts say, well, it was just a frontier, you know, a fur trade town, and then others will write and say, well, it was a very sophisticated a monetary town. There was a lot going on with the money and a lot going on in terms of economics.
Yeah.
And so you just kind of have to, you really do have to kind of pick and choose, do your research, but you really do have to kind of pick and choose what you present.
Yeah, well, everybody, any historian looking back at that is going to bring their own bias.
Yeah,
what they're looking
at.
So one person with an economic bias may see that it was a flourishing center.
Right.
But somebody that doesn't have that economic background may not see it that way and would focus on some of the other aspects.
Well, and also my feeling about it is that unless you lived in that era, nobody knows what it was really like. Nobody. So you just have to do the best you can do, and I wanted to make it exciting too. And there's some bit of, I won't say alternative history in it, but there's I'm kind of going for a little bit of a Wild Wild West or James Bond type feel too, and that maybe this didn't happen, but it could have happened. It may be a little bit of alternative history. You know, I think we mentioned one time we talked that Nightbird won an award, a science fiction award.
Right.
You know, and I never could understand why it won a science fiction award for best book of the year in science fiction group. And I thought that was kind of amazing, but I think, you know, maybe because the way it's presented now, maybe younger readers see that as almost like as being as distant as you know, a rocket to Venus or whatever, or you know, a colony on the moon or whatever. You know, that it's so, it seems like such a long, long time ago that it's completely like another world.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where I'm going, that it's rooted in history, but it is sort of another world in a way. That was never reported in history books.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I'm going there too. Knowing I'm going to make mistakes, and I've made mistakes. I made mistakes in Nightbird. I made mistakes in Queen of Bedlam. Because I really did the detail. The detail in Queen of Bedlam is really, there's a massive amount of detail in Queen of Bedlam. And I think the more detail you do, the more you're going to mess up, of course. You know, the more potential for error.
Yeah.
But it's a learning experience for me, too. Because, you know, I've done so much research on every possible thing I could. But some things are going to, I'm going to miss some things. I just am. But I'm going to learn for the next book, you know. To either hold back my detail or make sure. The problem is when you assume anything. You know, when you assume something, you may be working on something, you've got 10 things to work on, and you say, well, you know, I'm just going to assume that. And that's the thing you're going to mess up on when you assume something. And that certainly happened to me.
Yeah.
So I learned quite a few lessons about assumptions. But you know, you just read, do your research, and understand that you are creating a world and creating an atmosphere to suit your mystery. And to suit your characters.
The level of detail in Bedlam is impressive. But it never gets in the way of the story. I find it interesting to see the aspects of life back then, but they never overwhelm what's going on with the characters.
Well, good. I'm glad. I'm glad. Good. Well, yeah, I didn't want it to be too overwhelming. In the next book, the details won't be as overwhelming because you know it's a real challenge to do a series. Novel. I've never done a series before, and so the challenge to me is in this new book, in Mr. Slaughter, how much do you go back and redo the detail that you've already done for people who are just getting into the series? You know, and that's a challenge that I'm trying to face, because I have some carryover scenes in Mr. Slaughter that have to do with events in Queen of Bedlam. So my challenge is, how much do you explain to people who haven't read this, who haven't read Queen of Bedlam, or not? You know, what do you need to do to get people into the story? So that's something that I'm having to deal with right now. But now I'm not sure that I need to go back and redo all that detail that I did of New York City, because I've already done them. I did it in Queen of Bedlam. I don't think I need to do it again.
Yeah.
In Mr. Slaughter.
That makes sense.
But like I say, I've never done a series before, so it is very challenging.
Were you able to get some at the convention? Were you able to get some pointers on how to do that kind of thing? Or?
Well. You know, there were people doing historical mysteries, but nobody was doing anything in this era.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing that I talked to some other writers about was basically consistency. You know, making sure everybody's consistent. And even so, you find out that some people realize they have messed up on consistency, even the descriptions of major characters.
Yeah.
So, I messed up on that, right? You know, so. The thing is, you just try to get the consistency down as much as possible.
Yeah. Well, that's something I've been keeping an eye on
good.
I've read the stuff, looking for.
Good.
Not that I.
No, I need that. I need that. You know, because really, there's so much in these books that you really do need more than one person watching out. You know, watching and making sure that everything gets done as it's supposed to get done. Yeah.
Without getting too far into spoilers for the book. There were a couple of things that I, particular scenes that I found very interesting, like the proverbial bull in the china shop.
Oh, right.
Or the pottery.
Right, pottery shop, right. Right.
And don't really have anything to say for that, except that
right.
I just think it's a wonderful scene.
Well, I wanted there to be actually a bull in a china shop, and this is as close to a china shop as you can get as a pottery shop. So, you know, I had this thing developing and.
It works.
And so
I
wanted it to be. And the whole thing, that whole thing came out of the most bizarre thing you can ever imagine, because one of my daughters, Skye's favorite movies is Ghost in the Invisible Bikini, right? And the lead character, we watched that over and over. It was one of those movies where it's so bad. It was one of the beach movies in that genre.
Uh-huh.
And it's so bad that it's good. It's funny.
Yeah.
So Skye and I watched that over and over this summer. So. The two ghosts, one of the ghosts is played by Boris Karloff. He's Hiram Stokely is his name. And then the actual ghost in the Invisible Bikini is named Cecily. So I said, all right, Skye, for you, I'm going to put those names in this book. So Hiram and Cecily, or Cecily the pig, and Hiram, you know.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, where do you go from there? You can't just put the names in. You got to build something from there. And so it kind of built from there that Cecily, that the pig knows something is going to happen, and you know, has this foreboding of something that's going to happen. It just went from there. But then I got the opportunity to say, well, what, you know, I've always heard this, something like a bull in a china shop.
Yeah.
What would it actually be? And here's an opportunity to really have a bull in a china shop, pottery shop, because you've got bulls in the streets.
Right.
You know, so go ahead and do it while you can.
It's a wonderful scene.
Good. Good. Good.
While it obviously brought to mind the bull in the china shop, it didn't pull you out of the story because it seemed a natural
natural progression
of the events.
Yeah, yeah, and everything, like I say, everything being a series, there is some continuity to that thing. I mean, it did. There is some continuity to the. It's not just that it happened, and it's not gonna. I'm not going to mention it ever again. There is some continuity that's going. I'm going to talk about in Mr. Slaughter that something happens because of that.
Yeah.
So yeah.
That must be fun.
Well, it is fun. It's a tricky thing to make sure that you know that everything doesn't exist in a vacuum. That whatever is done and something was done in Nightbird, that's going to come back in three or four books. And I've got it planned out that there's something's going to happen. That some character is going to come back. And then there's something that's going to happen later on because of what happens in Queen of Bedlam, you know. And I figured this out, that these things are not going to exist in a vacuum, but they're going to continue on and have some meaning later on in the series.
Some of the other scenes that, I guess with Matthew and the Herald Agency and how that all comes about, Just really interesting,
good.
Fascinating to see how that all developed.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
well, good.
The sword training and stuff, is that?
The sword training. Well, I bought three swords. I bought three rapiers, and I was going to take fencing lessons. And I determined, I found out that you really can't get any rapier fencing lessons anymore. It's all foils, which is the long thin. So that's not going to help because I need the weight of the. So I got I found on the internet. And the internet, you know, I couldn't have written this book without the internet. And I'll get to that in a minute. But I found three or four books, old books on fencing with a rapier, and I kind of taught myself. Of course, how can you teach yourself? All I'm saying is I taught myself the moves.
Yeah.
Heavy sword. I mean, how these guys could use a sword like that, unbelievable. Recently, within the last 10 years maybe, a skeleton was found in Williamsburg, and they determined the man was a swordsman because the bones of one arm were bigger than the other. The bones
really?
Of the forearm were bigger than he was obviously a swordsman because he had, just like a tennis player.
Yeah.
You know, they're. But anyway, he actually had been sword fighting, using the sword so long that the bone was actually bigger.
Wow.
But a heavy sword, you know, how they could use that in fighting, and unbelievable. But, you know, obviously they could.
Yeah. It's very interesting stuff.
Thank you. Thank you. And, but I was going to say about the internet.
Yeah.
Used to be that I would go and do my research just at the library, and I would have a list of questions. I would have a list of questions that I needed, or a list of research items to look up the library, or call somebody and go from there. And, you know, in these particular books, you have so many questions all the time that if you had to wait the next day to go to the library,
yeah,
it'd be years before you could get the thing done. It would be years to be able to finish the project.
Yeah.
Because I'm sitting there thinking, I have a scene where Matthew goes to get a horse. Now, you need to know something about, I'm not necessarily going to write it, but I need to know something about what the inside of the stable is going to look like and get the horse and everything. And I'm not going to write that, but I just need to know that for myself. All right, now he's going to go on a trip the next day. Now, about how far can he go on a horse? You know,
yeah.
How far can he reasonably go on a horse? Now, if I didn't have the internet, it'd be like, well, I have to wait till tomorrow. I can't go on any further till I get this information at the library.
Yeah.
All right. So you get the information about the horse's gait and how far the horse can go. Then you're writing something else about something, and then you'll have another question where you'll think, well, I can't, you know. Because these are things you can't think that far ahead. You can't think to write down. You know, these are very specific questions that you need answered. You need them answered right now, you know. So you're going to have to use the internet. But I could not have probably written this book. It would have taken years without the internet.
Yeah. So you have found useful sites?
Absolutely. You know, the clothes, I found an entire manual, entire book on terms used by, as they would call them, the lower class of colonial person and British person, used by the rascals and rapscallions, this type of gutter language.
Yeah.
You know, that, and I haven't used a lot of that, but having that is invaluable.
Yeah.
And I did find a book that I bought actually at a bookstore in colonial language. But then I found this other gutter language book, you know, actually right there on the internet.
Yeah.
So the internet has been really invaluable. And again, the internet is, I mean, you can find anything there, but I think you have to be careful too. You have to check check sources for sure and find it a couple of places. But I found a couple of things that, you know, I'd never heard of before, and really some of the people who worked with me on the book and edited the book had never heard before either, and it took them by surprise too that this particular thing was true. So it's been really interesting to do and vital to use the internet.
Yeah. Well, and you're lucky that the internet is where it is now.
Oh yeah. Even a few years ago it wouldn't have been because, you know, you're still going to get, when you put in colonial America, you're still going to get the revolutionary.
Yeah.
You know, and that would have been true 5 or 6 years ago. But now you can find, you know, you can find all sorts of things, and the list of the mayors, the list of the reverends at Trinity Church, you know, it's amazing. It is absolutely amazing that everything's there.
Yeah.
You just got to look for it, you know. You just gotta, and then what's not there, you can always make up. So,
yeah. Was there anything else about Queen of Bedlam that you want to?
I'm very excited about doing having a challenge in a in terms of the series, and looking forward to reading these books. You know. It's so exciting to me to be doing something that I'm looking forward to doing.
Yeah.
That has that the character carries on and the people carry on, because I really like the characters. I love the era and the feeling of the era, and that this mystery is going to involve the character Professor Fell is going to evolve, and he's going to come and Matthew's going to come into contact with him physically pretty soon, and then there's a larger scope. There's something else going on. You know, it's very exciting because there's a lot ahead. There's a lot ahead, and there's a lot to look forward to.
Look, your characterizations have always been one of your strong points, and when you
Thank
read
you.
These books, I feel like I
Thank
know
you.
These people.
Well, I did go to Trinity Church. I went up to my last trip to New York. Did I mention this to you about the church, the cemetery? Well, I went to Trinity Church. Sally and Sky and I did, and we walked around the cemetery at Trinity Church. And, you know, some of the streets are the same. Some of the streets, Stone Street, where Matthew's office, number 7 Stone Street is there. It's a transit authority building there now.
Yeah.
But anyway, went to the cemetery, and you walk around the cemetery, and just about every stone there is washed clean of anything, any date,
yeah.
any, you know, they're so old. They're just washed clean. But I really had, I almost came to, had a little tear, came to tears a little bit there a little bit, because, and I get emotional about it still, because you look at these graves and these people, and I felt so like I knew what that was like. I mean, I knew
yeah.
what the town was like. I felt like I had some bond with these people who lay dead in the cemetery, and I was speaking for them in a way,
sure.
you know,
yeah.
Which is kind of weird and presumptuous of me to be saying that, but I felt some kind of kinship with the people who were dead there, and that's how real they were to me.
Yeah. Well, that's something that you wouldn't have unless you've done what you've done with the research and stuff.
Yeah, I
easily see where.
Yeah.
To somebody who hasn't even at least read the books.
Yeah.
They're just graves, old gravestones.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's just fascinating to me that the I needed a word for that meant sorrowful or sad. And you know, one of the things I really have to have is a book of word origins, because you got to make sure that they're not using a word that you know didn't come into being years later, and so that's tricky to do. And I'm always checking that book to make sure that whatever word I'm using is not, you know. But I needed a word that meant sad or sorrowful, and I think the line was going to be, shall we shamble off to the nearest bar and drown our sorrows, or something like that. And I started trying to find shamble or to walk sorrow. I could not find a word that meant to walk in sorrow or to walk sadly or to proceed sadly. The world was so hard. Life was so hard. They had many words for joy, but few words for sorrow or sadness. Because since that was just such a matter of fact, it was hard. I mean, life was hard, so you just didn't cry about it.
Yeah.
You just went on. But joy, if you had joy in your life, you expressed that. Sadness, that was just a moderate. It was just part of life.
Yeah.
So you just went on day to day, and I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. I'm trying to remember if something sparked while we were talking about that. Well, I was just going to say this related to that, but I tried to read The Last Templar by Michael Jenks, which is a medieval mystery set in the 1300s.
Yeah. And I've seen that, but I haven't read it.
I couldn't get into it. And part of the reason is that it didn't ring true to me. His dialogue seemed a bit too modern. And I can appreciate the decision, as you did in Spooks and Ivory. The language is not exactly what it was then.
Right.
Because that would be unreadable.
It would be very hard to read, yes.
But you still get the flavor of it.
Mm.
And in this book, the dialogue just seemed entirely too contemporary.
It did.
And so I just never could get into it. It was like the only thing about the story that, the only reason that you knew that it was set in the 1300s is because the author told you it was.
Oh, really? Yeah. So
there's no feeling. Whereas with Speaks of Nightbird and Queen of Bedlam, you get a strong feeling of where you are.
I hope I can keep that.
What the people are like.
That's good. I hope I can keep that going. I think there are some instances where I kind of stepped out and did a little bit more modern language, but I did it later on in the book. I think as you go further on, read further on in Queen of Bedlam, there are some instances where somebody says something and the girl says, lady says, well, we got that, or something like that. It's more modern. But I thought, it's okay. It's okay to you can do a few things later on, but I think first you got to set it up where you are. But later on, you can kind of play with it a little bit. Which I did a little bit with the language.
One of the things that, one of the lines that I saw, somebody was talking about having their work cut out for them.
Yeah, yeah.
Which just, maybe that was actually used back then, but it just struck me as being a bit too modern slang.
Yeah, well, that's why I use this etymology book.
Yeah.
But it is like a Bible to me. I've got that, beside, and I'm using that all the time. And it can be very frustrating because you have a really good line, and then you find out there's no way, that this word was not used in that way until 1725 or so.
Right.
So nope, can't use that. Got to find something else, and you got to check it. I mean, you got to really be on it and be checking it, because I'm a stickler about that. I want to make sure that as much as possible, the words that are used, and the dialogue can be. You can make the dialogue stiff, or you can make it breezy, or whatever. But you got to make sure that the actual words, suit the era.
Yeah. It worked in the first.
Yeah. Time. Good. Good.
So, how much do you want to say about Mr. Slaughter, which is the next book? Is it too early to say?
I guess it is. I've really just started it. I've got it finished mentally, but I've just started it, and I'm about 60 pages into it, and hoping to be finished with it in February. It is, what can I say? It's more of a manhunt piece than a Sherlock Holmesian mystery, which I guess Queen of Bedlam was, and also Nightbird was.
Yeah.
This is more of a like you're hunting a fugitive. Cross-country fugitive hunt type book, and there's more to it than that, of course, but that's the gist of it. And I wanted to do something that moved fast, and it's fast and it's pretty violent. There's a lot of violence in it, it adds it adds to the overall story. It adds to the overall reach of the whole project. And I view that the whole thing is like you're reading one book. Because everything merges, and because all the books are set, they're only set at most a few months apart.
Yeah.
So everything merges together. So by the time you finish the whole series, you will see how everything merges together, and it kind of is like a sweep. So, anyway.
Part of the reason that I think that the books work so well, too, is it's not just historical, it's not just a mystery, but these are still great coming-of-age books.
I think so. Well, I hope so. Matthew begins the new book is a little bit stuck on himself because of what happened in Queen of Bedlam, and he's been written up in the earwig, and he's a celebrity now, and he's beginning to think a little highly of himself, and he's beginning to go out and buy some new suits from the tailor. He wants to look good. He wants to look like a young professional, a young gentleman, and he's beginning to get a little bit too fixated on money, and he makes a mistake. But he learns a big time lesson.
Yeah, sounds good.
So yeah, I hope it'll be good. It's exciting. It's fun for me. Like I say, it's great fun for me to read this first and say I want to read this. So to read it, you got to write it.
Okay. Anything else you want to say?
No, I think that's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,